Thank you very much, Henry. Thank you for joining us. So just to start with, I often when you hear about sports people who have got one particular skill, they're people who are driven, and they're often people who basically do nothing but that one thing in the early days. You know, I mean, and I guess the question is, were you born with a cricket ball in your hand? You know, were the kids saying to you, you've got a great arm, you'll go a long way, you're going to play for Zimbabwe?
Not at all. And if you followed my career, you'd wonder how I ever got an international career. Because when I was about, even when I was about 17, I used to spray the ball. I was a wild bowler. In fact, it was said of me that I didn't know where the ball was going. But I thought, if I don't know where the ball's going, how's the batsman going to know, right? So I basically had the attitude of, in fact, from a young age, I thought I was going to be a runner. My dad's Kenyan, and having come from Kenya, I thought that was a logical career path for me. If you've ever watched the Olympics or the, you know, international championships, and there's a Kenyan running, they're probably near the front of the race. So I thought, in fact, there's another Kenyan who ran a race recently, Barack Obama, and he won as well. So Kenyans are good at running. And so that's what I thought I was going to do for most of my life, up until the age of about 16. And then, sadly, my athletics coach at the time, his name was Atherton Squire. He was an amazing coach who'd got me running times of 10.6 in the 100 meters as a 16-year-old, which is pretty good for a 16-year-old. You're on your way up. Nothing to say I would have gone on to be a decent athlete, but I had the makings of an athlete, perhaps. So for a long time, that's what I dreamt of doing. And cricket really only came to the fore when I was about 17, 18, when my cricket coach sat me down and gave me this dream, although I will say that I played cricket from the age of 8.
So when did you realize you could run?
Well, I must have been about 8 or 9, and we were at home for the holidays, and the ice cream man had passed our house, and normally what they do in Zimbabwe is they have a bell, and they used to ride on these tricycles with a big box with dry ice in it, and the lollies and the cones and all that sort of stuff. And he'd come and gone, but we could hear the bell in the distance, and you become a pretty good judge of how far the guy is, but I guess he was about half a mile away. And I found a dollar coin in the garden somewhere, and I said to my brother, guess what, we're having ice cream today. So I raced him to the ice cream man. I had what we call pata-patas in Africa. I think you call them flip-flops here. We call them pata-patas because the sound they make when you walk, of course, as they flap your feet. That's what I was wearing. I was wearing flip-flops, and I beat my brother, whom I can't remember what he was wearing, but probably wearing trainers. And when we got there, he said, boy, you're fast. And so he was the first guy who ever, I suppose, affirmed this gift for running in me. When you're a kid, you don't know how good you are until it's related to someone else. You know, you don't know if you're good at drawing until you see someone else's drawings. Then you go, oh, that's really good, or I'm really bad, or whatever. You know what I mean? You can compare yourself. But it was only, so that was the first occasion. The second occasion was, I was at my junior school. It was a school called Reps. It was in an area called the Matopus. Now, obviously, here in England, if you walk around a corner like I did and you hear a rustling sound next to a dustbin, you assume it's nothing dangerous. I mean, it could be a mole or a rat or a hare or something like that. In Africa, it could be an elephant or a crocodile or an alligator or something. So you check it out. So I turned around as I came around the corner to see this African spitting cobra looking at me. I was only about, like I say, 8 or 9, so I wasn't very big. I was quite short. And he was looking me in the eye, so I don't exaggerate, but he looked about that big to me. Obviously, when you're small, everything looks big. It's a bit like when I meet some of my old teachers. They look a lot smaller, do you know what I mean? When I was a kid, they looked like giants. But either way, maybe this thing looked bigger than it was, but it just was a monster. And all I can say is about 5 seconds later, I was 100 meters away. So if Usain Bolt had raced me that day, I would have beaten him. And that was another sign to me that running was something that came naturally to me. And then I just fell in love with running and athletics and track and field. We watched the Olympics in the mid-80s, 1984, I think it was. I can't remember where that Olympics was. Somewhere in the States, I think. Yeah, that's right. And Carl Lewis was running. And also Daley Thompson, of course, the great decathlete, performed there, I believe. And they just inspired me. And so that's where, I suppose, when I was about 8 or 9, where I got my love for running. And that was to remain, like I said, until 16.
So how did you get then from running to cricket?
Well, like I said, from the age of about eight, I took cricket up as a sport. It was an alternative sport. The way that the seasons went in Zimbabwe, we have summer, winter, summer. Oh, joy. We don't have this long nonsense called winter and then autumn and all that. We just go summer, winter. So you have three terms, and the first term and the third term are very similar, save for the fact that the third term is a bit rainier. But they're both hot. So your sports are cricket in the first term, along with track and field. In the second term, we had football and rugby, which is our winter, which is summer here. And then in the third term, December side of things in the year, we had cricket again and swimming. Now, I've got it on hard scientific evidence that black people are not made for swimming, okay? We've got heavier bones, apparently. And proof of that is, have you ever seen a black man in the finals of the freestyle 100 meters of any Olympics? It's not likely to happen. So I decided, given the choice between swimming and cricket in the third term, I'll take cricket, thank you. So I played cricket twice in the year, first term and the third term. And it just became one of those sports that I played. But I wouldn't say that I played it anymore with any more enjoyment or application than any other sports. I played rugby as well. I also played tennis, and so I just enjoyed all the sports that school offered, but never once did I think that cricket might be it for me.
Most of us here have been brought up in England. You've obviously spent a fair bit of time in England now, but you were brought up in Zimbabwe. But how does Zimbabwe and England compare?
Well, Zimbabwe's warm for a start. Look at what I'm wearing tonight. So that's the first thing. The weather is obviously very different. The people are, and this is not disparaging in any way to English people, but the people are very, very, because the majority of people live very simple lives, they also tend to be very simple as well in their outlook. They're very peace-loving. They will entertain strangers quite easily. Mm-hmm. It's in the culture. It's inbred. So people tend to be very friendly. I explain it this way. If we had... I don't know if anyone's been down to London here. I know there are a couple of people who are from London, work in London. But if we had a tube in Zimbabwe running in one of the big cities, people would talk to each other. It wouldn't be odd if someone said to you, good morning, how was your day or weekend? Here in England, people look at you as if you're nuts. So I find that quite a stark difference. But that's a cultural thing. Africa, of course, has got its own problems. Aside from bad leadership, it's got issues with poverty. And disease and, you know, low life expectancy and all those other issues which make life very difficult and challenging, I assume. Whereas here in the West, people are very comfortable. You know, they've got most of their material needs met, if not by them having a good job, certainly by the government paying them benefits. I know they're changing that now, but at one point it was more lucrative to get pregnant at 16 and get given a house and benefits, you know, whereas there's nothing like that in Zimbabwe. So people put a value on a good education and family values as well. Oh, that big one. I could go on. I could speak of so many things. Britain, of course, is becoming, the West, is becoming a lot more secular. Whereas where I come from, people still have a semblance of a knowledge of their creator. Very big difference.
You mentioned bad leadership in Africa and, of course, in Zimbabwe. But that was your perspective of the leadership in Zimbabwe wasn't always that. I think at one point in your book you describe Mugabe as a revolutionary hero. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, I don't know how much people know about the history of Zimbabwe, but I'll just be very brief. Zimbabwe used to be a colony of Britain, but it was called Rhodesia. Ring a bell? Rhodesia lasted till about 1980. But around about the late 60s, the leader of Rhodesia at the time, Ian Smith, decided to defect, if you will, decided that he wanted Rhodesia to be independent under a thing called UDI. That then started the process of civil war. And a few guys like Mugabe and another guy called Joshua Nkomo got thrown in prison as leaders of this revolution, if you can call it that. He spent, I think, 11 years in prison, Mugabe. And then around about the mid-70s to the late 70s, they started negotiating because the country was struggling under sanctions. And cut a long story short, they came to the table and they decided to have majority elections. That happened in 1980. Robert Mugabe, of course, swept to power. It was a landslide, I think, in the elections then. And he's been the only leader Zimbabwe's known. Now, for my most of my childhood, I never questioned what I was told, which was that Robert Mugabe's a hero. If you look at the history of Zimbabwe, it's very similar to segregation in America. You know, there are a lot of injustices that needed to be addressed. It was almost like apartheid in South Africa as well. You know, black people and white people couldn't use the same toilets, couldn't drive in the same, you know, be in the same buses, that sort of thing. So naturally, with those sentiments and those issues being very, very divisive and very sensitive, naturally people would have wanted to see an end to them, and the majority of the people in the country empowered, which happened. But they failed then to see the flaws, the potential flaws of Robert Mugabe in the early days, and all they ever sang were his praises. And so, cut a long story short, some of his weaknesses became apparent. Early on, in fact, in the early 80s, he committed, I wouldn't say genocide, but there were a lot of people who got killed in an area I grew up in called Matabeleland. They estimate almost 30,000 people, you know, lost their lives early on. So we're talking 1983, 84, 85. So we're not talking, you know, recently. We're talking right at the start of his tenure as president, prime minister, and then president. Cut long story short, eventually, of course, in the late 90s, he showed his true colors with the farm invasions, et cetera, et cetera. I know it's a very divisive issue. Some support it, some are against it. But either way, it destroyed the country, destroyed the livelihoods of thousands of people. And Zimbabwe is a different place now, just about bouncing back from the economic chaos that happened in the last few years. So, start off with, yes, I was told in the textbooks he's a hero, and yeah. I believed it, and I never questioned it until I started to hear stories filtering through that, you know, there were all these awful things that had happened to people.
Mm. Okay, so we've heard a little bit about Mugabe, and presumably we'll hear a bit more about that in a moment. But one of the things, so obviously you were eventually going to become the first black cricketer for Zimbabwe.
First clumsy black
cricketer. we've heard you sing already. You've told us about all the different sports you're involved in. And just, it's a question I'd like to ask you, just because when I was 18, I had a conversation with a friend of mine, and he said to me, Tom, I'm too busy. And I think God will understand that. I'm busy, I've got all these things that I do. You know, I'm into, he played music, he was into sport, he was into, at the weekends he was busy. So he said, I think God will understand that I'm too busy. But you're a busy man, so did you have any time for God? How did God feature?
Well, kind of kicked in from an early age. I moved from country to country when I was very young. So I was born in Zambia, in Lusaka. And then we moved to Kenya, and then in 1980, just after independence, we moved to Zimbabwe. So three moves in the space of a few years. And then I got sent off to boarding school from the age of eight. So from 8 years old, I was away from home and really being influenced by teachers and peers, you know, school friends, etc. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened at school was church was compulsory. It was a great tradition of church. It was Anglican in both my junior school and high school. And you had no choice. You had to go. So we'd go there, and we would very often sing hymns. There was a piano in my junior school, an organ in the senior school. And we went through the rigmarole of, you know, the Anglican service. You kneel, sit up, stand up, all that sort of stuff.
So at this point, the time is being made for you. Then there's no.
No, absolutely. Yeah. So I have to do this. I don't really have a choice. We're hearing good messages, and they're all hitting home. You know, some of them are talking about being an honest student and working hard and giving your best and never giving up and all that sort of stuff. But there's the odd, you know, message that comes around. We used to have a group of people from Scripture Union come around, and they were very adamant about, you know, talking about the good news and the bad news, you know. And the good news, of course, is that, you know, Jesus came and died on the cross for us, but the bad news is we're sinners and we need salvation. So I had heard that over and over and over again. So come high school, I'm not a kid who hasn't heard about God and Jesus, and every time we had Easter in Zimbabwe on the one TV channel we used to have, they would play the film Jesus Christ of Nazareth, Franco Zeffirelli. I think it's about 6 hours long, that thing, but anyway, they just played on the whole day, and it's quite, I think it's the book of Luke, it's quite insightful. I don't know how accurate the portrayal is, But every time I watched it, there's something inside me broke, you know, just seeing this innocent man dragged away, crucified, and they were quite gruesome. You know, they showed nails going in and blood and all that sort of stuff. And even though I was a kid, it moved me. I wouldn't say I was a Christian, but there was something quite heart-wrenching about it, that an innocent man would die for the sins of the world. I found that quite moving. So anyway, cut a long story short, come to the age of 16, and I've already gone through my quest to find out what truth is. Call it this. I was trying to answer the questions, the big questions in life. We all deal with them at some point, and then we make our minds up on them. Let me propose that they are, where did everything come from? What's the purpose of life? And where do we go when we die? Is there anything beyond the grave? Is this it? So those are three questions I think we all ask, and I was pondering those questions. I didn't know I was pondering the three questions back then, but of course, in hindsight, I can see that I was. And I tried a few things. I tried to find significance and substance in sport, but I always found it had an anticlimax, as it does. You know, you can win as many times as you like, but there's this falling off that happens. I don't know how to explain it. I had a lot of success as an athlete. I'm not trying to boast or anything, but I won a lot of races, but there was always an emptiness I sensed afterwards. I also tried to find it in other methods that never satisfied. And then eventually I said, you know what? Let me go to the place where I've always heard there's truth. And the reason I say that is because we had heard so many times, over and over again, that there's this man called Jesus who claimed that he was the way, if you're looking for the way, claimed he was the truth, if you're looking for the truth, and he claimed he was the life. So I think all those questions, three questions, sort of get answered in amongst that little phrase that's tucked away in the Bible. Jesus claiming he's the way, the truth, and the life. And so I'd been pestered by a few friends of mine. I mean, I'd really been bugged by these guys about giving God time in my life. And I'd always, you know, just poo-pooed them and sort of pushed them aside. But eventually I said, you know, I've tried a couple of things. Now, I'll say this. I'm not the kind of guy who tried everything. There are people out there who've tried everything and they found it hasn't satisfied. A guy in the Bible called Solomon who tried everything and it didn't satisfy. So, you know, wealth, possessions, lots of pleasure, partying, sex, whatever. I guarantee at some point you're going to realize it doesn't truly satisfy your spiritual hunger. And eventually, I then decided to go on a Christian camp. I knew it was a Christian camp. I knew what I was getting myself into. But you know the reason I went? I'll tell you what the reason I went, Tom, was every time those guys came back from camp at the start of the next term, they always had something about them that was exciting, that was just energetic. And I wanted it. I really did. And I didn't resist. I wasn't one of those people who had a hardened heart, if you will, towards spiritual things, towards God. I wasn't angry with God. I wasn't bitter. I was just the guy who was searching. And so I went to this camp. We had a blast, and we had a lot of fun and games. And eventually, on the penultimate night of the camp, I heard the gospel, the good news. This guy got up there, and he stood up, and he preached this message that, you know, God is our creator for a start. He made everything. And as the creator of all, he basically has the right to tell us how to live. He provides a wonderful sun to give us warmth. He feeds us. Everything that's made is his. Mm. And if it's his, we have a responsibility to acknowledge him. It's a bit like your parents. You know, your parents fed you when you were young. It's a bit like you just not caring about him. I mean, you know, what ungratefulness that would be. So God is creator, and he made us. And God is just. And this was explained very clearly through some scripture references, a couple from Romans. One of them says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And that suggests that we don't make God's mark. We don't meet the grade as far as his justice, because he has to punish us because we've all transgressed. We've all messed up. We've all sinned. We've all done wrong things in some way or other. And don't think you're a good person. It's a disease, you know, this. I'm not such a bad person because I'm not a murderer or a rapist. Apparently, if all of us have sinned, then you fall into that category. Well, maybe you have lust in your heart. Maybe you're a proud person. Maybe you don't give, you know, a generous person. You're selfish with your goods. I don't know. But either way, we tend to compare ourselves with other people when we consider this question, are we a good or bad person? And in God's eyes, hey, he said, you all miss the mark. So that was hard to take, but I heard it, and I'd heard it before, that we're sinners. And I don't have a problem accepting that. I didn't, because I'd been given six of the best ones as a school kid. We still had corporal punishment when I was going to school. And I said something I shouldn't have said to another student, and I got the maximum you can get as a school kid. So I had at least that sin to go fall back on, and I also had the marks to remind me as well. It was painful when it happened. That's why it wasn't a problem for me to understand that I wasn't perfect. And then, of course, I heard the story of Jesus, who he is, why he came, because God loved the world. For God so loved the world, John 3:16, that he gave his only son, so that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life. Perish, that word perish, it's an interesting word. This guy didn't explain it to us like that. He just talked about hell. and obviously, in this politically correct world of ours, people don't like the notion of hell. But I heard about hell a lot when I was growing up, and it was a place I knew I didn't want to go. I knew that if there was a hell and there was a heaven, given the choice, it's kind of a no-brainer. I would want to go to heaven. So what did I need to do? Well, I needed to repent, according to this gentleman. I needed to acknowledge I was a sinner, that I'd missed the mark, that I needed saving. And basically, he led me through a quick prayer. In fact, it wasn't just me. There was a whole group of us. And we just, you know, came to the point where we wanted to follow, or at least allow God to be a part of our lives and to follow his way. I was 16 at the time. And ever since then, it's been a journey. I obviously now that I'm 35 almost, I know that I'm much closer to God now than I was then. But I won't say that God was first in my life from the start, but I knew that something significant had changed. I started to have a clearer conscience. I started to feel a bit deeper. I started to feel bad if I did something wrong, whereas prior to that, I couldn't give a monkey's. And I also started taking interest in the Bible and in the church services as well, and really get moved and motivated to be a better person, if you will. Better person, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. More holy. And so there was a small change starting to happen in me. And I basically grew and grew and started to read the Bible, started to attend what was Christian group. And over a period of time, I got to know this God, who's very real, who's been very active in my life and in the lives of millions of other people on planet Earth, who have a similar story, which is they gave God a chance, they listened to his voice, they heard him calling them, and then they decided to change the direction of their lives by surrendering to him and giving him the time of day. Mm. So in answer to the question, if this young man, he wouldn't know when his last day would be. He says, oh, well, God will understand. But what happened if he died prior to knowing God? In fact, I heard someone once say to me that you can live all your life without God, just don't die without him. So what happened if that kid died, your friend that you counseled, prior to him making this all-important decision to hand his life over to God? I can almost say with some assurance that if he didn't do that, he's not going to be in heaven. And so I have that assurance of knowing where I'm going when I die. I know why we're here, because God created us. And I know what my purpose is in this life, which is to have a relationship with him. And that's an awesome thing. So that has underpinned my life. And when I left school, I went into cricket, but I was a Christian, even though I was a cricketer. And when I left cricket, I was a Christian, but I've gone into all sorts of other things. I've done cricket commentary, I've done art, I've done music, I've done painting. I've done many things with my life, but undergirding all that is the spiritual reality in my life, that I have a personal relationship with God, which is open to anybody who wants it. And as a result of that, I ought to, at least, give God most of my time, which is certainly something I'm aspiring to. I haven't arrived, but I'm certainly at a place where I recognize God as creator, and I want to give him the room that he deserves in my life.
That's helpful. And I think particularly when you're talking about a turning point in your life, you know, when you changed the way you lived, there was something quite significant there then, because again, there's something, you know, you talked about there was a semblance of God in your country. You talked about you were brought up going to church, but then that didn't mean too much, because again, another thing that people in England put to us is, well, you came from Zimbabwe, they were a Christian country, there's a lot more Christian, we're not a Christian country, so you become a Christian because your family, your country's Christian. How would you answer?
Well, some people would still cling on to the fact that they think that, you know, Britain is slightly Christian. I think a lot of people are nominal Christians in this country, even in Zimbabwe. In saying that, what I mean is they go through the rigmarole, they go through the rituals, but they don't necessarily have a personal relationship with the Creator God. What I mean by that, do they hear God speak to them, you know, in an audible voice? No. But they have a personal relationship. I relate with my wife in a very real way. When I mess up and I've offended her, I have to try and make right. I apologize. I say, I'm really sorry, honey, I shouldn't have said that, or and vice versa. And she makes me laugh, I tell jokes, she smiles, she tells jokes, I laugh. we relate. We're friends. We are in a relationship. I think a lot of people view God as, sadly, slightly unapproachable, and they approach him through the cloak of religion, which is more a system of things that you do to make you feel better. Now, the funny thing about Christianity, of course, is it suggests that there's nothing that we can really do to make ourselves any more worthy of God. He's reached down to us to come into our existence. And so we do get a lot of religion back in Africa, trust me, and we get a mix of all sorts of weird things as well. Mm. I wouldn't say it's too different. I think the whole world is almost heading in a direction that I think is more and more increasingly secular, even though Zimbabwe is slightly behind the curve. But we know that. Zimbabwe and Africa, developing countries, are slightly behind the West in most things. So the sad thing for me is the nominal Christians in this country, the people who kind of think they know God because maybe their parents know God. You know, my mother was a Christian, so I'm a Christian. I don't quite agree with that. Also the people who went to church and think that their church attendance makes them acceptable to God as well. And again, I think that that's possibly a mistake to think that. And I don't know how to define this. I'm not going to try to define it, but I know there's a difference between me knowing of the Queen and knowing the Queen. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Hello, Your Majesty is slightly different from, oh, look, there's the Queen, I want a photo. And there's a difference between relating with someone and just knowing them. And I think the majority of people around the world, even in Zimbabwe and here, just have this distant relationship with God based on etiquette and things they think they're supposed to do. And it worries me slightly. Hence the reason I try to travel around the country and share this wonderful message that God actually wants to know us personally.
I understand you did have a personal conversation with the Queen once, though.
No, I missed her. I did meet the Queen, as in, I was part of the Zimbabwe cricket squad that came to the World Cup in 1999, and of course we went to Buckingham Palace. Huge ceilings, by the way. Who needs ceilings that high? But there you go, amazing place. You can get lost in the Persian rugs as well. But just got to, you know, hang around and mingle, and didn't say much, as you would imagine. But I met her, and she's obviously a lovely lady.
Well, back to cricket then. So you become the first black player to play on the Zimbabwean team. What was that like?
Well, I was 18 years old, and I just left school. I'd written my A-levels, GCSEs, as they're called here, advanced GCSEs. And I went out, and I walked onto the pitch. Of course, it was quite an occasion, and the spectators gave me a standing ovation, which was fantastic. And then I bowled my first ball in Test cricket, which made all of them snigger. It was four wides down the leg. So they all probably thought after that, what have we got ourselves into? Can this kid even play? But then I got a wicket with my third ball in Test cricket, which doesn't happen often on debut. And then I got called for throwing, which is a technical, you know, problem. I had a dodgy action, so to speak. So this all happened in the space of about 2 hours. I've gone from hero to zero to hero to zero. And it was quite a bittersweet debut. And it meant, with my technical problems, that I had to go off and deal with this action of mine overseas. I went to India. I spent some time with Dennis Lilly in Madras, and a guy called Joel Garner, played for the West Indies in the 80s and 90s, well, 80s. I also went and spent some time in South Africa to fix my action, and also spent some time in Australia where I met my wife as well. So I went on it took me about 3 years to fix it, and then I came back into the international fold. So my debut was a forgettable debut, although, you know, we won the match, which was our first test victory as a test playing nation, so that was pretty special, but very sad for me.
But you do go on from there to do quite well. I understand you had like one of the top cricket contracts or something. You ended up becoming a guaranteed to play.
Yeah, we went on a tour. Actually, that match over there, we just played a test match in Harare a couple of weeks prior to that, that match that you saw, the video clip. And the selectors, just prior to this test match, had come to me, and I'd just injured my groin muscle as well in a warm-up match. And they said they were going to pick me, and it was kind of like my last shot. Basically,
that's this one, is it?
No, not that one. The test match. So basically, the guy said to me, "Listen, we've given you a couple of chances for 3 years now. If you're going to make it as a cricketer, Henry, you have got to go out there and you've got to perform this match." So I had a bit of pressure on, under me, and so off I went, and I bowled in the first innings. We made a modest score, 250 or so, and then I took 5 wickets when they batted, and we kept them to a decent score as well, around about the same. And then we batted again, got something, I can't remember, 200 and something odd. And then we bowled them out again. So we won a test match against India, which is no mean feat. I mean, they're a top team. Tendulkar was playing in the match. All the greats, Azharuddin. And so it was a top team, and we beat them. And so that pushed me on to get selected for the one-day side, which was going to Sharjah, which is the match you saw playing there. But that match was a dead rubber. In other words, it didn't count for anything. Teams that were going through to the finals were already decided, but it was still a match we had to play, so they could risk Henry longer. So they whipped me in. So I played in the side, got these wickets, and in a funny way, I didn't look back after that. They then started picking me more and more and more, and I had about 3 or 4 years of good sport where I performed really well at the top of my game, and then the end came.
Right, the end came. Tell us more about the end then. How come you're not playing cricket now?
For a start, I'm 35, and I think I'm way over the hill now. But basically, and this is a long, convoluted story that I'll condense into about a minute. Basically, myself and Andy Flower is the current coach of England, decided that we wanted to protest against what was happening in our country. Many things had happened. There's lots of vast corruption in the country. There was vast human rights abuses. It was just at the peak of the land invasions, which was destroying the economy. Long list of things, you could say. Police brutality, rigged elections. I mean, this is the country that I was representing. And so in the end, him and I decided, just the two of us, we would protest. We wore black armbands to mourn the death of democracy. And we wrote a statement to argue as to why we felt it probably would be a good idea for the people who were abusing people in Zimbabwe to stop. Nothing more than that. It was peaceful. We weren't suggesting people take to the streets and protest. It was a peaceful protest in all its forms. It was very symbolic. We were just going to wear a black armband. And I got death threats after that. And I had to leave the country. There's quite a story behind that, which I'm sure you know because you've read the book. But I saw the miraculous provision of God like I've never seen before. Trust me, most people want to believe in a God when their back's against the wall. And I wouldn't say I'm that kind of person, because I'm not. But when my back was against the wall, I saw God come through for me. And that just strengthened my faith twice. The first time was an extraordinary change of weather that enabled us to get a result, which got me out of the country. And the second was a total stranger who didn't know me from Adam, saw me on TV, and it was impressed on his heart to help me. He got me into his office, and I needed an airline to come to England, but he didn't know that. And he happened to own an airline company, and he bought me an air ticket to fly to England. There's a bit of a story as to how that happened, and people are welcome to do their research, but either way, it was extraordinary how, obviously, first of all, the reaction of the government, which we thought was an overreaction. Come on, we just protested peacefully. But it made some people mad to the point where they would threaten me. And secondly, to see the protection of God. That was amazing.
So, can we just go back to some of that then? So it was a peaceful protest.
Yep.
You were just going to wear a black armband. So why did it all kick off then? Just a black armband?
Because to put it simply, Robert Mugabe's a dictator. We've just seen in the news with Libya, what's going on there with Gaddafi, what ruthless dictators can do to people who cross them. And what's his name, Saddam Hussein, I mean, if you hear the stories of why certain people were killed sometimes, it's just bizarre. Mm. So the football team would lose a match and they get flogged. I'm glad I didn't play for them. So dictators can be cruel. And if you cross them, you criticize them and they don't like what you said. It was on the world stage, the billions of people watching the World Cup. They didn't like it. And I'm not surprised they didn't like it. We weren't complimentary. But death threats, I thought, was a bit strong. So obviously it meant I had to think of how to get out. They weren't going to do anything during the World Cup, by the way. I had it on good evidence that they were going to wait. And then, but thankfully I got out. There was a way made. and I got to relative safety and then came to England in around about May after retiring from world cricket. So in the end, it was as simple as that. I protested, the government reacted, they started writing horrible things about us in the papers. The threats came, and so I had to leave.
Okay. So can I ask you a further question on that? Do you mind?
Absolutely.
So I have been reading the book, and I've been enjoying the book, and to be honest, I'm chuffed you told the milk float story. I really wanted to hear that story, so I'm chuffed you told. But
milk float?
Yeah, sorry.
Ice cream man. Float. Oh, okay.
What's that, American? I don't know where that's come from. Yeah, the ice cream van story and the flippity flappity thing.
Flippity flappity.
But so when you first, I mean, because I don't know, you've told this story very quickly, and to be fair, I mean, this is...
I don't know how much time we got. You don't know me, Tom. I could take 2 hours to explain the story, but I'm trying to be...
Cool. We've got a bit more time.
Trying to be nice to people.
I mean, this is a big thing, isn't it? You know, you to stand up against Mugabe, this is no... It's not like me going in with a little, you know, red ribbon. This is something much bigger. And you send out this letter that you've written, a statement that you and Andy Flower put together. And you do that. You talk about you've got this big kit bag, or coffin, you call it. And all your guys, they come and they read this, or your teammates read this. And what was their response? How did it feel? Because
Tom is asking a question that with regards to the morning of the match when we did the protest. So this
and
was
you're going out to play cricket.
Yeah, like, this was on the 11th, 11th of February, 10th of February. Can't remember. So we were playing our first match. Zimbabwe were playing their first match in the World Cup of 2003. We're playing it in Harare, the capital city. And you probably don't know this, but Mugabe's house is next door to the cricket ground. So. There you go. That's the scenario. So we embargoed the statement till 9:30, because at 9:30, once a team is announced, or once a toss happens, they can't change the team. So we had to cover every base, and one of the bases would be, what happens if they change the team after they hear we've done this? So that's what we did. 9:30 comes, the toss happens. Andy Flower pulls a statement out, puts it on the coffin, as we call it, and says, guys, Henry and I have... I've written a little statement. You're welcome to come read it. There were a few copies. Handed them out. And of course, there were varying reactions. Some guys just glanced at it and weren't really interested, put it down, walked away. Others sort of looked at it and were slightly stunned. But the majority of them were very, very complimentary. I don't think any of them wanted to show their affirmation of what we did publicly. So it was the odd sort of thumbs up or pat on the back, that sort of thing. But most of them, I think, understood the gravity of what we were doing as well. Mm. And so, you know, kept their distance.
And your situation now, although you and Andy Flowers are both doing it, your situations are actually quite different, because he's kind of come up with he's got a future in mind, hasn't he? But so in one sense, you're putting yourself in more of a risk, because Andy's got... So tell us a bit more.
Yeah, well, Andy was going to retire after the World Cup. So, and Andy was married and he had... 3 kids at the time, and his future was come back to England, play county cricket for Essex, and settle down. And of course, I don't know that he wrote this into his future, but become the coach of England. and you know, he's done very well for himself. How was the tie the other day? Did anyone watch it? My word. I was asked in a radio show what I thought my predictions for the match were. I said, no, India going to kill him. So you can imagine how I feel. They chased 328 or something. But anyway, he's done a fabulous job as coach. If I may say. But I was rather more naive. Maybe the better side of me felt that they wouldn't react the way they did. Having said that, we did this on the understanding that the worst case scenario might happen, which is that I might have to go into exile, or indeed I might die or go to prison. It was a price we were willing to pay. Mm. It was the back of our minds. It wasn't a price we wanted to pay, but hey, we truly believed in it that much, that if it cost us our lives, you know, fair play, because what was happening in Zimbabwe was just ridiculous and it needed to be challenged. Edmund Burke, the great philosopher or whatever he was, poet, I don't know, can't remember, maybe even politician, it was him who said, all that's necessary for evil to prosper is for good men to do nothing. Now, I'm not going to say we're good men, Andy Flower and I won't say that, but we certainly couldn't wait around and do nothing. And so it motivated us, this situation in our country, to do it. So yes, I was slightly more naive, but you know what? I wouldn't change a thing. And I think if I'd planned my life afterwards, some of the things that happened to me wouldn't have happened the way they did, and I think they were for the better. I know it sounds a bit crazy me saying that, but certain things needed to happen the way they did for me to be in the place that I'm in now, and I wouldn't change a thing.
Now, it wasn't just one match, though, was it?
Well, we wore a black armband for the first match, but then the authorities clamped down on us, and they said, you can't wear black armbands for the second match. So we wore red ones. Said, you can't wear red ones, we wore white ones. So we played a bit of cat and mouse for a while, and then it got serious. They hauled us in, and they gave us a little naughty schoolboy talk, you know. We were grown men, you know. I'm 26 at the time. Andy Flower, and they hauled us in separately, and they, you know, basically dragged us over the coals, slapped us on the wrist, said, you're not allowed to do anything else or else there'll be trouble. And so, you know, that's when it obviously dawned on us that there was pressure being put on them. They put that pressure on us. And so we, in the end, they banned us from wearing anything that wasn't official kit issue. And they also stopped picking me on the side. Mm. So I didn't play too many more games. I played one more game right at the end of the World Cup, but they didn't pick me, which is quite sad for me because I was bowling quite well. I thought I was bowling better than some of the guys who were being picked, but obviously the politics got in the way. Andy himself carried on playing, though. He got his full quarter of matches because he was a key player in the side. Alonga was dispensable, not Flower. So, but at the end of the day, I think, you know, Zimbabwe got as far as we could have. We got through the Super Six stage, which for me was very important because it got me out of Zimbabwe and into South Africa, because the Super Six stage was all being played in South Africa, or the Super Eight, I can't remember what it was. I think it was eight. And that was the main thing for me. We got out of the country, and I was away from relative danger.
So you got out of the country, your dad got a message, and you came and you left. You've come over here in England. What are you doing now? What does life look like here in England?
Well, I've done a lot of things in the past. I did, like I said, when I first came, I did some cricket commentary with Channel 4 for a season. Zimbabwe were on tour, one days and test matches. I also worked with the BBC. I worked with Test Match Special, with Henry Blofeld, Eggers, CMJ. Great learning curve, you know, for this new kid on the block who didn't know a thing, and just to learn how it all looks from the commentary box was amazing. Seeing the Lord's Ground from the media center was quite a stunning experience. But I quickly realized that's not where my heart was. I can still do commentary today, you know, if I'm asked to do it, but it's not really something that grabs me. And so after that, I got involved more in other things. I decided, you know, I wanted to go back into the things that I enjoyed doing at school. So I flirted with the idea of getting back into music. So I did. I started singing again. And then I started to do art. Then I started to do photography. These are all things I did in high school. And rediscovered my love for them. And I just came alive. And for a long time, I, you know, didn't earn a penny from it. Couldn't make a living from it. So I had to subsidize it with after-dinner speaking at cricket clubs. And I also play for a club called Lashings. And we travel around the country playing against really weak opposition that we can find, because the team is made up of former internationals, so we've got reputations to protect. So we pick really weak opposition. I'll give you an example. Last year we played against a school, and I scored my finest innings yet, 75 not out. It was Sutton Valens Prep School, and those are the kinds of people we'd like to pick. So, but apart from that, obviously one of my passions is sharing the good news of who Jesus is, why it was necessary for him to come. In his eyes, not in ours. I mean, we didn't force him to come, but his love for a lost humanity that needed saving made him come to earth. And, you know, Britain, I weep for Britain, because there's so many people who think they've got it right, and actually they've missed it. And one of the problems with this country, this nation, is that the overt leaning on academia. People think that the only way you can explain everything is through the science guys. You know, if the scientist doesn't say it, it's not true. Mm-hmm. And so people just lean on the mental side of things and neglect the spiritual. And so I'm just another guy who's out there traveling around. There are many of us some in this room as well, who love the Lord Jesus, and we know that they're people who think they're okay, who are not okay, and if I may be blunt, who are on their way to hell. And if I was to go to hell, if I wasn't a Christian, and I ended up in hell one day, I would have wanted someone to tell me, even if I was arrogant and proud and didn't want to listen and, you know, was resistant to the message, I would have at least wanted someone to tell me, there's a horrible place you don't want to go. This is the way to go to the right place. And so it's called evangelism. It's called sharing the good news, proclaiming what God has, this message, that he opens his arms wide open to any sinner who will repent, any sinner who will realize that they're not living a life that pleases God. And it's compelling enough for me to leave home. I've just, by the way, just had a little daughter born just after Christmas. She was due on the 26th. So thankful I was able to watch the Boxing Day test because she came on the 28th. she's just a bundle of joy. So I'm a dad for the first time. And of course, that's another thing that has added on to my life. She's just a joy. She's starting to smile, starting to go, that's her first sound. She's trying to talk. We don't know what in the world she's saying. So fatherhood is obviously something else that's come along and is taking up a bit more of my time. But ultimately, music is my main thing. And traveling around sharing this message.
Thank you very much, Henry. Well, you brought some books along. This is Henry's book about his story, which I have read, and it is a very good read. We're selling them at the back for £15.
And that's £3.99 off, just so you know.
And Henry's happy to sign a copy as well if you would like that. So we're going to start our interval, but don't go anywhere because Henry's going to sing to us some more.
Now or in the interval?
After the interval. Yeah, sure. And we're going to hear some more about his Christian life as well. So thank you very much, Henry.
Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed the light refreshments. Whatever they were, I haven't a clue what they were. I see people with drinks. I don't think there were any nibbles. But now, we don't have much time, in the sense that we'll be done soon. I've just got to sing a few more songs to you, and then I'll share for a few minutes something that's on my heart, and I hope you'll receive it. And then I'll hand to Adrian, who will share ever so briefly about where you can go from here, and a few things that are being put on in the coming months. And then I will sing one more song, and then I think we'll call it a wrap. So thank you for coming. But my next song is a song called You Raise Me Up. How many of you have heard the song You Raise Me Up? It's been sung by a few really, really good people. A guy called Josh Groban sung it, another guy called Ronan Tynan sung it, and then a little-known boy band from Northern Ireland, Ireland called Westlife sung it as well. So here's my really poor version of this great song. Hope you'll be inspired. When I am down and all my soul so weary, when troubles come and my heart burdened be, then I am still and wait here in the silence until you come and sit a while with me. You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong when I am on your shoulders. You raise me up to more than I can be. There's no life, no life without its hunger. Each restless heart beats so imperfectly. But when you come
and I am filled with wonder. Sometimes I think I glimpse eternity. You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong when I am on your shoulders. You raise me up to more than I can be.
Right, I'm going to share for a few minutes. Will you allow me to be candid? Is that all right? May I be candid? May I just speak from the heart and speak truthfully? Because we do live in a world now where you're not allowed to say this or that because someone's going to be offended, right? I'm not going out of my way to offend anyone, but I'm going to be honest because I believe that the words that I shall share are the truth. I may come across as slightly deluded or out of touch, but that's okay because my worldview is very different to the worldview of a lot of people who live in modern Britain. My worldview, as I'm sure you've already picked up this evening, is that we aren't actually the result of a big accident that happened billions of years ago by which we have everything that exists around us. I just don't believe that. I just don't think it's logical. It doesn't make sense to me. But the story goes something like this. Billions of years ago, there was nothing. It exploded, and then out of the nothing came the big ball of dirt, which was the primordial earth, and then there was the soup that formed on top of it. We don't know how or why, but it did. And then there was a bolt of lightning that zapped the soup, and from the soup came the first amino acids, the building blocks of life, which then led to the first fish, first amphibian, first land-walking mammal, first gorilla, which was your great-great-great-great-great-grandparent. Something like that. Now, listen. The majority of the world is invested in this. Have you noticed that? Every time you watch the BBC, what do you hear? Billions of years ago, evolution, billions of years ago. It's so drummed into our minds, the majority of people assume that it's true. Because if you tell someone something long enough and often enough, they'll probably just assume it's true. I come from a completely different perspective in that I actually don't want to listen to any man tell me what they think happened in the beginning. I want to listen to the testimony of one who cannot lie. And I make a big deal about this because we place a great deal on the credibility of a person giving evidence in court. People are called witnesses, they're called forward, and the defense attorneys try to undermine their credibility. Was it dark? Have you had your eyes tested recently? You know, have you ever lied in your tax return? You know, that sort of thing, yeah? But there's one being in the whole entire universe who can't lie because it's against his nature. That's the kind of witness I want to have when you're dealing in a debate like this. When you're dealing in an issue that's so divisive that people will call you a lunatic if you're on the fringes, if you're on either extreme. People throw insults across the pond. You're a creationist, oh, you're a creationist, oh, you're an evolutionist, you know, and it gets quite muddy. So if you want a witness to listen to the one witness that can't lie. In the dock, can't lie because it would violate his nature, God. God can't lie to you. And he says that he's the creator. I'm not going to get into the length of days and all that sort of stuff. That's far too complicated. But all I know is God created us. Now, if it's true, and I believe it is, and God created us and gave us, as in humanity, a very simple instruction, which was to obey him. I mean, that's the direction that Adam and Eve should have gone. And that's the direction that the rest of humanity should have gone ever since them, our first parents. But we have this propensity to go our own way. It's called rebellion. It's called the sinful nature. It's the tendency to say, I want to do what I want to do, and no one can tell me otherwise. In fact, we've seen the proliferation of this since the 60s. Take, take, take. Have as much as you like. As much sex as you like. As much drugs. Have as much pleasure as your body can give you. Don't take time for God. No. Just take. Rebellion is good. It's good, actually, to rebel. That's the message we keep getting in the movies, on TV. Sorry, BBC. Radio. Yeah. It's cool to be a rebel. Nice guys come second. Bad boys or bad girls come first. And so we're seeing a culture, it's enculturated in everyone's psyche now, that God's irrelevant. Doing good is passé, it's so yesterday. And if we're not careful, it'll creep into our lifestyles and into our lives. And it poisons us. In fact, I'll go as far as saying this, it can deceive us. You know, this man called Jesus, right, apparently he was there at the creation, so he creates everything, and then he sees the dilemma. He's a just God who must punish. I've already touched on that, but he has love for us. So he takes on a body, a human body, and he comes into our world, and he suffers everything that human beings suffer. He's tempted in every way, just like we are, but he never sins once. And God is pleased with his death on a cross. That's a pretty serious thing. If there is a God who can't lie, and he's told us that we are his creation and we are beholden to him, and he tells us we've got a sin problem, and he kills his son on a cross in the most inhumane way possible, I think that's pretty serious. I take it pretty seriously when these planes come back with dead bodies from Afghanistan and Iraq. I probably would have taken it seriously if I was old enough to have seen those bodies come back from Vietnam. I mean, I wasn't old enough at the time. But when I see someone giving their life for their country or for a cause, or when you hear stories of brave men and women, firefighters, for example, dying in the line of duty, policemen shot, doesn't it fill you with a sense of indebtedness? I mean, I certainly feel that. But with this man called Jesus, it's bizarre. He was a man who lived on earth, tempted in every way, did good all his life, and never did evil towards anyone. Not once. He only did good. Healed the blind, delivered those who were oppressed from evil spirits. He fed people miraculously. He only ever did good. And yet, where's the indebtedness? Where do people not even feel a pang? Don't you even feel something that makes you say, wow, what an incredible thing, what an incredible gesture? At least you should feel that this innocent man died for you. What would prevent you from feeling a sense of understanding what the whole gospel message is about, that God loves you and God has dealt with your sin on the cross? Maybe two things. The first is the one I've tried to deal with. It's called unbelief. It's the refusal to believe in spite of seeing pretty compelling evidence. Unbelief. It's a refusal to see that this world that we created, that's created around us, is quite an amazing place. It's a refusal to understand that it could only have been formed by an almighty, incredible, all-powerful God. It's a hardness of heart. We see it in the New Testament, actually, when these guys called the Pharisees, they were the leaders of the day, saw this man, Jesus, God in human flesh, performing a miracle. He healed a blind guy. And they were incensed with Jesus for doing this. And in fact, it was their routine to do this. They always picked holes. Why did you do it on the Sabbath day? You know, instead of, a guy has just been healed. He was blind and now he sees, and you're worried about what day it was done on. This is the way they were. Because they had hardened hearts and they had unbelief, you see. So they never saw the forest from the trees. They always sort of got caught up in the wrong little things. They made mountains out of molehills and lost the mountains. The big issue was a blind guy had just seen. Then they started getting into this argument, and they called Jesus evil. It was quite bizarre. Are we in danger of doing the same thing because of unbelief? Getting angry at someone who's died for us? Poured their blood out for us? Oh, you know what I mentioned earlier? I used to watch this Franco Zeffirelli movie. Like I said, it was really long. But we got the whole story plotted out in that. It was beautiful. You see Jesus' birth. You see him grow up, little boy. You see him in the temple teaching the elders. You see him grow up performing miracles in his ministry. And it's an amazing story. The words that Jesus said when he was here on earth, he said things like this. He said, I didn't come into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world. The Son of Man came to seek that which was lost. He said incredible things like that that suggested he was a good shepherd. He gave parables about there's 99 sheep, one goes astray. Will he not leave the 99 and go and look for the one that goes astray? He tells a parable about a prodigal son, a son who claims his inheritance early from his dad and goes off to a big city, spends it, wastes it, ends up broke, living in a pigsty, comes home, and dad's got wide open arms. And that's the picture I have of God. I don't have the picture of God that Richard Dawkins has. I'm not mad at God. I don't see God as withholding or as angry. I see a God who is a father who wants to give his children good things, including eternal life. You know, the world we live in now is a wreck. It's not the way it's supposed to be. And I think we even have a sense of that soul sorrow inside of us. Whenever we hear of some heinous crime on TV, there's a part of us that just, we just go, this is not right. If you're sensitive to these things, it's a broken place. If the Bible's to be believed, that's not the way God created it. God created a perfect place, and there's an evil one out there. He's called the deceiver. It's called many other names, but let's just dwell on that. Jesus said of him, remember Jesus said of himself, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He says of the deceiver that when he lies, he speaks his native tongue. He comes to kill, to steal, to destroy. So you've got these two kingdoms, if you want to call them that, at war with each other. You might not realize it, but by default, if you do not decide to be in God's camp, you're in the other guy's camp. See, by default, Jesus puts it this way. Broad is the road that leads to destruction. Many travel on it. Narrow is the road that leads to life, and few find it. Do you want eternal life? When I heard this message, I was 16. I wanted to know where I was going when I died. I wanted to go to heaven. I want a future that suggests I'll be in a place where there's no pain, no disease, no sadness, no sorrow. That's what the Bible promises. I wanted to know that I'd be forgiven of my sins. I mean, there's some bad things I've done in my life which I wish I could undo. And there's some people I've had the chance to apologize to. And it's a great feeling of having that weight of unforgiveness lifted off your shoulders. I've experienced that with God, knowing that my sins are forgiven. Okay, I'm not the biggest of sinners in the sense that I haven't done the big crimes, but yes, I've sinned many times, many, many times. And if you're honest with yourself, you know that you've sinned as well. So we shouldn't be having a debate about that. But let's, just in case there's someone who's smugly thinking, well, I'm okay, I'm not such a bad person. Well, there are many sins of commission that you can commit, things you do that you're not supposed to do. Throw the Ten Commandments in there. Throw some of the commandments in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, some obscure ones. But how about the stuff that's in the New Testament that goes deeper than just rules? What? Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Have you done that? How about having no prejudice in your heart towards any person? Huh? How about going the extra mile, just like Jesus says you should, or turning the other cheek? Have you done that? Well, if you haven't, maybe you sinned. How about attitudes of the heart that no one else can see? You know, lust, you know, pride, anger, hatred, envy. Yeah, those things, they disqualify you. They do. The Bible puts it this way, for all have sinned, fall short of the glory of God. The Bible also says the wages of sin is death. We all, those of us who work for a paycheck. And we know what we deserve at the end of the month. And the boss can't demote you to half your salary just because. So you know what you're working for. And you deserve it. And sin has a wage as well, and it's death. And it's not just physical death, which we see is pervasive around the world. We die. But it's also spiritual death, and not just separation from God, but eternal punishment. Some people might not believe that. I certainly think it's plausible that there's a place called the lake of fire that burns forever and ever, where God has to separate everything that's corrupted so that there's nothing corrupt in heaven. It's kind of the garbage bin of the universe, so to speak, because you know that you don't keep the garbage bin in your bedroom. It just doesn't make sense. You've got to make a separation. The kitchen, when stuff that's corrupted goes off, it makes everything stink. So God can't let that into heaven, so to speak. I know it's a weak analogy, but you get the picture, right? So he's got to separate it. He's got a place called hell. The wages of sin is death. But the gift of God is eternal life. The gift. And a gift is free. It's a gift you can do diddly squat about. You can't earn it. You can't pay for it. You can't be better. You can't try harder. You can't say more Hail Marys. You just receive it. This is the message I heard when I was 16. And I tell you what, it's so true even today. It's blown my mind that actually there's nothing I can do to earn my way into God's court of favor and grace. It's unmerited, it's unearned, it's undeserved. So what are you waiting for? Do you know what I mean? It's like, why does he's good? He created us, he's good, he provides for us, he loves us. There was a thing called sin, he dealt with it on the cross. And then he invites. Why would you say no? And he promises to have you in a place where there's no pain, no tears, no... Unbelief. That's the only reason I can think of. People refuse to believe in spite of the compelling evidence. It's quite a world out there. There's much evidence to show that Jesus existed. He's a real person in history. You can find him. Just open the textbooks. Josephus, a historian, secular historian, Jewish secular historian, wrote about him. There are other historical records that prove this man called Jesus died. And they've never found his body. Hundreds of his disciples went to heinous deaths, proclaiming that what they saw, what they witnessed was true. I mean, if it was a lie, I mean, most people will die for the truth, but no one's going to die for a lie. At some point, they'll say, hey, no, I was kidding. No, he didn't feed the 5,000. No, he didn't get raised from the dead. No, but some of these guys were burnt at the stake, sawn in two, awful deaths. To the death, they proclaimed, this man was who he said he was, did what he said he did. Many prophecies written in the Old Testament that were fulfilled when he came. I mean, the evidence is out there if you want to find it. It's just, you just got to look for it. You just got to seek. Most people have hardened hearts and are not interested. Fossil fuels, I love this. You know, there's compelling evidence that there was a flood on Earth many years ago, which corroborates the Bible's account. You can see rock strata all over the place. You can see, they find shells on top of high places like Mount Everest, which shows that it was below sea level at some point. You can find archaeological evidence for places that are mentioned in the Bible. It's compelling. If that's not enough for you, how about looking out on a clear night sky? Maybe you got to get out of Bradford and Leeds and go into the country where you can see the light. The stars. And then pick up one of those books made by NASA on the vastness of the universe and let it blow you away. And to know that the creator of all that is seeking you gently, quietly, saying, Donna, John, Peter, Cynthia, I want you. I want you to be a part of my family. I want to forgive your sins. I want to cleanse you. I want to take all your guilt away. I want to change the direction of your life. I want to fix things. I want to bless you. I want to call you my child. Amazing. He doesn't have to. He's God. He's perfect. He's holy. He's up in heaven. But he came down to us, to our level. He did that 2,000 years ago physically, and he does it today. He comes down in meetings like this, in a message, and he knocks on your heart. Book of Revelation puts it this way. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. A physical door, not a door of your heart. It says, if any man or woman, any person opens the door, I will come in and fellowship with him and he with me. Or have supper, have a meal. In other words, have fellowship. We'll be friends. We'll be in a relationship. It'll be like I know you. Not like, ah, oh, there's the queen. It'll be like, here's the queen. But this, in this case, is the King of Heaven wanting entrance into your life. We talked earlier about a guy who was too busy for God. Please let that not be you. God wasn't too busy for you. It cost him everything. It cost him his life. In Africa, when people come and they give us gifts, we generally accept them, even if the gift sucks, because it's disrespectful to not receive a gift. I wonder if people are so materialistic in this world that they're satisfied because they got a faster car or a faster computer, a better iPod, better iPhone, or better this, better that, that they become a bit blasé about things, receiving things. Maybe people are too cynical. Maybe that's what it is. People are cynical. What's the catch? We've heard of these Nigerian scams. You know the ones? You know where they ask for your bank account details? And they say, well, yeah, my brother, I'm just, you know, I'm a king's son and we've been deposed. And if you let me deposit this money in your account, I'll give you 10%. That's the whole thing. And we've seen so many of those that we think anything that looks too good to be true is. So there's a catch somewhere. Apparently with this, there is none. Okay, there's one catch. Let me explain. The catch is you surrender. That's a catch, I guess. In other words, you don't have your way anymore. You don't selfishly go through life living for yourself. You actually take into consideration what God wants. Okay, that's a catch, yes. I'll grant you that. But I think that's the easiest thing. It's the most natural thing for someone to do. It's to surrender to the Creator. He made us. He knows us. And he's interested in us. I'm flattered that my mom takes an interest in my life. I am. When she calls up, how you doing? How's baby? It touches me. But to know the King of Heaven is equally interested in me, that's amazing. I don't know who's here who doesn't know God. But if you don't know God, I want to tell you right now, God's pursuing you. And, you know, you might be sitting there looking at me thinking, this makes sense. Yeah, I want to do something about it. And Adrian's going to come and, you know, very eloquently explain how you can pursue it. But from my perspective, if anything, I'd just like you to get something out of this message. Very simple. I don't have all the answers. I'm not a guy who will claim that I have a monopoly on truth. I don't think there are many people who can say that. But I think I've met God, and he claims he knows the way. If you're searching for the way, I can point you to Jesus. He's the way. He just... forgive me, maybe I've said some things that don't quite make sense or they're a bit out there. That's fine. Just have an open heart. Don't harden your heart. Don't. Just be open to the notion that there is a God and he's interested in you and he wants you. My word, he wants you. So bad. He doesn't have to, but he does. He wants you. So that is essentially the gospel message, the good news. I'm no theologian. I don't know if I explained it perfectly for everybody's tastes. But to me, that's just it. Is God loves you. There's an issue of sin and he's dealt with it. All you got to do is humble yourself. Get off your high horse and understand he's greater, bigger than you. And he wants you. And he's humbled himself to our level. That says something. Why don't you just humble yourself to his? Humble yourself, bow your knee. So if you're someone who's searching, seeking, I'll hand over to Adrian now and he can explain perhaps what you can do next.
Come back here. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Don't go away though, because you're going to sing once more. Thanks so much, Henry, for coming. It's been a real blessing for you to be with us. And my name is Adrian Watts. I'm one of the organisers of this event. And I want to take this opportunity to tell you three more things that we're involved in, you might be interested in. The first is a Christianity Explored course. It's a six-week course. Each session we look at a short bit of a DVD, which explains part of the message of the Bible. And then there's a discussion afterwards. Now, it's a really informal course. We meet in someone's front room, put the kettle on. You won't be asked to read the Bible or pray or sing, but you can come and ask any question that you have. And it's a great course, especially if you've heard something tonight and you think that this is really, really important. These are issues of death and life, about relationship with my Creator. And you think, I've got to pursue this. Then why not come along to this course and find out more about the message? But it's a really good course. Maybe you call yourself a Christian and you just want to brush up on the basics. Then this is a really good course to sort of do that. If you want more information on that course, there's some cards on your table. And on the back, you can tick a little box to say you'd like to know more about the course that's running near you. Give us your details and we'll be in touch. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Tom and I are heading up a new church in Bradford called Trinity Church Bradford. It starts in May with regular midweek Bible studies, and then from September we'll be having regular Sunday meetings. So if you want to know more about that church and even how you could be involved in that, then again, on the card, tick the box. And if you decide to fill out this card, then before you go home, why not give it to me or Tom, or on the way out, there's some sort of buckets you can drop the cards in, and then we'll be in touch. Now, the last thing I want to tell you about is another event that's happening next month. Now, we've talked about cricket. We haven't played cricket tonight, but next month, it's a golf event, but we're actually playing golf. And we've booked part of a driving range and at Manor Golf Club. And we've got a PGA pro that's going to come and give some tips how you can sort of play better. And afterwards at the clubhouse, he's going to give a short talk, because the PGA pro is a Christian, give a short sort of talk, a message from the Bible, and there's soup and sandwiches, and we can sort of enjoy a time together. Now, for that event, you need to book it. So this event, you could just turn up. That event, you need to book. It's £7.50 just to cover the costs. So if you would like to be a part of that, see me or Tom tonight, or take one of these cards here, and there's contact information, email address, telephone number, you can get in touch. But thank you very much for coming. I hope you had a really, really good time. And I'm going to hand back to Henry, who's going to take us out with a song.
Thanks, Adrian. Well, hope you've had a good evening. I hope you got some food for thought. If you have already started your journey and you believe in God already, well, I hope you're blessed. Maybe there are those out there who've had this journey before and you've kind of fallen away. Well, I hope you're encouraged. And also those people, of course, who don't know God at all, I would suggest to you, it'll be a tremendous experience for you to try and get involved in those events. This is a song called In the First Light. And it's just a song about the tremendous steps that God has taken to reconcile a rebellious world to himself. What is man that you're mindful of him, the psalmist says. What are we that God would care that much that he would want to save us? And I think, simply put, it's just the love of God compelled him to do so. So this song's about that. It's basically the gospel message in about 4 minutes. So I don't know why we bothered with an evening worth of chat. We could have just sung the song and gone home. But I hope you'll enjoy it. Let me just take a sip.
In the first light of a new day, no one knew he had arrived. Things continued as they had been, while a newborn softly cried. But the heavens, wrapped in wonder, knew the meaning of his birth. In the weakness of a baby, they knew God had come to earth. God had come to earth. Oh, God had come to earth. As his mother held him closely, it was hard to understand that her baby, not yet speaking, was the word of God to man. He will tell them of his kingdom, but their hearts would not believe. They would hate him, and in anger, they would nail him to a tree. They nailed him to a tree. We nailed him to that tree. I want to tell you, he hung there for you and me. Yes, he did. God's Son hanging on a tree. He did it for you and did it for me. But the sadness would be broken as the song of life arose, and the firstborn of creation would ascend and take his throne. He had left it to redeem us, but before his life began, he knew he'd come back, not as a baby, but as the Lord of every man. Hear the angels as they're singing on the morning of his birth. But how much greater will our song be when he comes again, when he comes again. Hear the angels as they're singing on the morning of his birth. But how much greater will our song be when he comes again to earth. When he comes again to earth. When he comes to rule the earth.
Thank you for coming. Good night.